Welcome to Pacific Mammal Researchers Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado,
welcome to the Pac-Man podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And this week, we're doing a marine mammal highlight, and it was between the Commerson's dolphin and the Hector's dolphin. And I think to both of Kat and I's surprise, the Commerson's dolphin, like, blew the Hector's dolphin out of the water.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I was kind of surprised about that, because they're both pretty cool, and they're both pretty cute. So, like,
it's
could have gone either way awesome. There.
I think the Commerson's, the coloration is just so striking. So when you see the two pictures,
yeah,
might have edged it out, but it was like 80% to 20% or something. I'm not sure. It was a lot. So we're doing the Commerson's dolphin today, and there's lots of cool stuff. Like I said, they're very, very cool looking, but they're hard to find and get to, as Kat will talk about. And they have some fun names, which I'm sure either Kat or I will get to eventually. Some fun facts, but so we're going to start off with what they look like, because they're so cute, and where they are with Kat.
Yeah, so I'm going to get into some of the names now, because as we talk about their appearance, this makes the most sense. So
sure.
Before we get into that, so Commerson's dolphins are one of the smallest of all cetaceans. So they only grow up to about 5 feet, so it's about 1.5 meters. Up to about 190 pounds on the heavy end. So that's 86 kilograms. Funnily enough, females are slightly bigger than the males. I'm not sure that it's really visually obvious in the field. I think it's kind of like harbor porpoise, where like it's not enough of a difference to really notice.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up harbor porpoise, because there's a lot of commonalities between these guys and porpoises. So you'll hear us continually popping in on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of, well, and it, funnily, like, they kind of almost look like a porpoise. So, I mean, they are a dolphin, but they have quite a blunt face. So instead of having that really prominent beak, they do have more of that kind of blunt, rounded rostrum. In terms of their coloration, like we said, they are very cool looking. So they have a black head, a dorsal fin and tail, and the body and the throat are white. And they have a really rounded dorsal fin. So one of the things that I saw actually referred to it almost like Mickey Mouse ears.
No,
which I thought was amazing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's totally what it is.
That's it.
And then the males have a black teardrop shape on their belly, while the females have a more rounded black belly. So if you do see their underside, you can often tell visually whether it's a male or a female, which is super handy if you're studying them.
It's kind of like with the orcas, the same thing, like those coloration patterns on the bottom are different.
Yeah. And so because of this really unique black and white markings, they do have some fun nicknames. So some of the fun ones that I saw were piebald dolphins, panda dolphins, or skunk dolphins, which is my personal favorite.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, skunk dolphins, done. That's hilarious.
Poor guys. But they don't stink.
I know.
They're not smelly.
No. They just look like, they just have the black and white. That's it.
Right.
So, and they don't always look like that though. So the calves are actually kind of more of a grayish color, and then the juveniles are gray black and kind of lighten up into this black and white coloring as they get older. So it takes about 4 to 6 months for that white coloration to really come in and start to look like a true adult. The other thing I will say about their appearance really quick, and we'll get into this a little bit more in the distribution in just a second, but they do have slightly different coloration and size in their different populations. So there are two different subspecies that we'll talk about. So there's basically the South American animals, and then the Kerguelen animals, which are more in the kind of the Southern Indian Ocean off the coast of South Africa, basically.
And if they're like, there's a set of islands, like the, however you said that word,
the Kerguelen. Yeah.
Yeah. They're islands. I think they're associated around those. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So these two populations do look different and kind of act different to some degree. So the Kerguelen population are larger. They're black, gray, and white in color, unlike the South American population, which are just black and white and slightly smaller. So just kind of interesting to note that they do have sort of area specific differences as well, which is again kind of like harbor porpoise, where we know that the Black Sea harbor porpoise population does look different than the rest of the world's harbor porpoise. So kind of cool. So in terms of where they're found, like I said, they do have these two subspecies. And the reason that is because they are very much separated geographically. So they don't mix at all. So typically the Commerson's dolphins are found in those colder inshore waters. They're typically associated with open coasts, those sheltered fjords, bays, or river mouths. And they do range from the tip of South America through the Strait of Magellan, around the Falkland Islands and the Kerguelen Islands. So kind of in that whole area, but they do seem like they are separated between those two populations. They don't really seem to intermix very much. The northernmost population in South America was documented on the Brazilian coast between 31 and 32 degrees south. Their range extends south into the Drake Passage, as far south as the South Shetland Islands, which I just had to throw in there because I'm from the North Shetland Islands in the Atlantic. And I always forget that there's another
Islands.
No. And I've actually had people, when I say Shetland, they're like, oh my gosh, you grew up near the Antarctic. And I was like,
yeah, no. I didn't realize they were down there.
Yeah. So kind of cool. I want to look into that and see why, like, where did that come from? Anyway. Mm-hmm. But on the west coast of South America, they have been reported in Chile as well. So so they do have quite a range around South America, but it's kind of seems like in terms of north, it's about that 31 to 32 degrees south point that they will extend up to. As I'm sure Cindy will get into with the behavior, we don't really know much about any migratory patterns of these animals. We do have the fishermen in local areas report that they disappear from their common areas in the wintertime. But aside from that, we don't really know where they go.
We don't know a lot about these guys.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing. So in this, you know, we've talked about other species that live within this sort of distribution range. And it's just, it's really hard to study animals in this part of the world. The waters are really gnarly. The currents are really gnarly. There's some really nasty seas and storms that can kick up in this part of the world. And there's just not a lot of research effort compared to other parts of the world.
Well, when you said Drake Passage, I think a lot of people know that that's like one of the most gnarly places ever around anywhere. So if they're there, yeah, like, yeah, we're not going to know much about them.
Yeah, it's really challenging. And even though they are typically found around these more coastal areas, they do seem to prefer water that's less than 200 meters deep. So in one sense, that's great because they're not going to be like necessarily super offshore. But again, just having the funding to create research efforts in these parts of the world is just really challenging. So I think it's interesting that we know as much as we do, given where they are actually. So that is what I have for what they look like and where they are. And we'll get more into their current status and stuff a little bit later.
Yes. So I'm going to talk about the diet and behavior, which is kind of quick. Because as Kat said, they are just a really hard place to study. And I agree with you. I think it is interesting that we do know as much as we do, because it's just an inhospitable place.
Yeah.
To be out on a boat. And that's really what you need to be around to see what they're doing. So the diet... basically they're opportunistic feeders. So, and that's pretty much the end point of that. They eat fish, squid, and shrimp. And I think one said octopus, you know, so it's always funny when they call out a squid versus an octopus. Sometimes I think that's specific. And then sometimes I think that's just whatever's reporting it is like cephalopod and like pick one of them. So I'm not sure if it, I saw squid more often than octopus. So I think we'll go with squid. The bycatch in South America, the animals that had been bycaught, had at least 25 species in their stomachs, mysid shrimp, three species of small fish and squid, and 17 species of invertebrates, four species of algae and miscellaneous plant remains. So that somewhat comes to, some of them are more benthic feeders. So I think they're getting some plants as they eat or from the prey that they're eating. But who knows, maybe they like to snack on some salad. It's possible. so then the Kerguelen,
Kerguelen, I think Kerguelen, is how you say okay. It.
That subspecies, they had possibly a more restricted diet that was mainly fish. And one study showed that there were mainly fish between 15 to 25 centimeters of, and again, this is similar to porpoises, right? Less than 30 centimeters is what they normally eat, of semi-pelagic. So pelagic is kind of more open waters. And I have no idea how to say this, but it's kynectiid, I think. Fish.
Cool word.
Yeah, it is. I may be saying it completely wrong, but there you go. And some coastal benthic notophanids, which I thought
Ooh.
Was, yeah, so look those
That's
up.
Also a fun word.
And then pelagic crustaceans, amphipods, hyperids, and euphausids, which are what a lot of the larger whales eat. Yeah. And then benthic crustaceans. And in one individual, there was numerous annelid tubes and ascidians. So worms actually do seem to be a part of their diet, not just an accidental one, which I thought was very interesting. And so they feed primarily on, you know, kind of more benthically seabed. But they will herd prey. So they do both places, right? So they feed on the floor and in the water column. So again, going to that opportunistic, whatever fish are around more in their area, and it is going to be kind of more particular to that area. So they will gather and herd schools of prey. So this is, you know, cooperative hunting, like you think of with dolphins, of up to 15 dolphins at a time. Sometimes they feed alone along the boundaries of adjacent currents. So again, very similar to porpoises, where they're going along those current lines. So there's two types of herding that they'll do. So one of the types is about 15 or less form a half circle and then drive the school of fish against the shore. So we've seen that in the other types of cetaceans. And sometimes the dolphins will strand themselves by accident. They're not actually strand feeding, but they're just pushing that against the shore. But they are able to usually get back in. So it isn't too much of a dangerous proposition, apparently. And the other type is that doesn't use a shore, but there's about 2 to 6 dolphins that circle a group of fish and take turns passing through the center before and then returning to the perimeter to let somebody else take a turn. So very, very common dolphin way of feeding, herding a bait ball. And so this part was really interesting is that they eat 3.5 to 6 kilograms or 8 to 13 pounds of food per day. Remember, they're only 100 up to 190 pounds on the high end.
Yeah.
That is proportionally more than a killer whale or bottlenose dolphin would eat a day.
Wow.
Yeah. So they say that's due to the 2 to 3 times higher metabolic rate. So again, very similar to porpoises, right? Small animals, cold waters, high metabolic rate, got to eat a lot.
And these guys are in colder waters than harbor porpoises typically. So that makes a lot of sense. And they're similar size.
Yeah, well, yeah. And they're similar size. Yeah. Because harbor porpoise is 5 to 5.5 feet, around 150 pounds. So very similar.
Wow.
So that's pretty much what we know about what they eat, mainly from bycatch or stranded and individuals, because you just can't see them eat. And some are from observations of these animals out in the water. So then behaviorally, again, not too much. I will note that they are also similar in porpoises in that they have narrow band high frequency clicks and apparently don't have whistles. So very similar to the vocalizations that we see in porpoises. And we're going to come back to that with the new research that's been being done. So again, very similar to porpoises, small groups of 1 to 3, sometimes larger aggregations of over 100. They are, as Kat said, found in those cold inshore open coasts and fjords and bays and harbors, occasionally at river mouths and occasionally in the lower reaches of the rivers. So they will go up a little bit, which is interesting.
Yeah.
For socially, we really don't know very much. In one captive group, so there are some that were in SeaWorld, and I'm not sure if other places have them as well, but there was a dominant male that controlled things, and the less aggressive males often resided in adjacent pools, so it does seem like there is some kind of social structure happening. Females appeared defensive of their young, which isn't surprising, I don't think, but I guess we don't know anything about these guys. But I guess another female tried to adopt the baby, and mom's like, I don't think so. this is my baby. So that's pretty much all we know about their social stuff. They are very fast. They reach speeds of 11 to 13 kilometers per hour. So it's pretty speedy. They love riding waves, breaking either. I didn't realize there's all these different kinds of waves. Breaking shore waves, bow waves of vessels, stern wakes of vessels, and wind waves, right? So all the different types of waves, they're just like, I don't care what wave it is, I'm going to ride it. They will oftentimes be seen doing aerial acrobatics, like vertical leaps in the water. And this is unlike harbor porpoises or porpoises in general, right? Porpoises don't generally like to do these kind of fun things, but so this is the one way that they're different. This one is interesting. They will swim on their back, and one website just says they swim upside down. And I was like, why is that unusual? Dolphins do that all the time. And porpoises do too. Like, we've seen it. But then I got clarification. They swim on their backs and they spin underwater on the longitudinal axis behind the pressure waves of vessels. So they're like,
oh, fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, that makes more sense why that's unique.
Interesting.
So they're very playful swimmers. They've been observed pushing objects like inflated inner tubes around a bay and onto the beach. And then observed surfacing under and nudging birds off of a rig. So they're like,
that's funny.
So they, and I'll leave this, put this in there for when we talk about the research. You know, it does seem like they have some kind of social, you know, a lot of times the porpoises are thought to be not social, right? And so these guys are similar to them. We don't know much about them, but it does seem that they have this kind of these playful behaviors and stuff. Like, they're probably more social than we give them credit for, and they're dolphins, so they're that tends to be more more social. Let's see. One other thing, in South America, they were seen swimming near and interacting with numerous birds and other marine mammals. So they like to hang out, and they commonly associate with Peale's dolphins, swimming synchronously for long periods, feeding in similar areas, and riding the waves with the same vessels. So they do, they like their friends, their neighbors, and they also associate with southern sea lions.
Hmm, interesting.
They're kind of indiscriminate in who they like to hang out with, it seems.
Hmm.
So lastly is reproduction. And this was one website gave me like one thing, and then it was like, that's all we know. We don't know too much more, but their breeding season is in spring and summer, which is September to February, because we're in the southern hemisphere. It does look like they do yearly breeding. So that's, again, very similar to most porpoise species. They did observe some copulation that was vertical and belly to belly. And then you already talked about what the coloration the males and females have. Both sexes are mature at 6 to 9 years of age.
Mm.
But the South Atlantic ones, not the Kerguelen, the other ones, the South American ones, reach sexual maturity at a younger age than the Kerguelen.
So, interesting.
Sure why, but again, there's going to be some differences, you know, between those for whatever reasons. Gestation is about 12 months. The calves are gray in color, as you said, for the first 4 to 5 months. They have one calf. The length of nursing is unknown in the wild. One said 9 months, another said at least 4 to 5. And in captivity, they start eating solid food by 2 months of age and whole fish by 4 months. So it's likely that 4 to 5 months is pretty much the starting of the weaning period, but could go longer, as there's always a range. And the first calf born in captivity, I didn't realize this was so early, was SeaWorld in San Diego, February 21st, 1985. I didn't realize they had Cumberson's that early in, you know, long ago, basically.
Yeah, interesting.
But little else is known about their reproduction, which is kind of interesting because there are some in captivity, so we don't know a bit more.
I wonder, though, I mean, a lot of times in captivity, because it's such a contrived situation to facilitate their reproduction, you can't really infer anything because you're sort of forcing it.
Right, that's true.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. I saw them at I forgot where it was. It wasn't SeaWorld. It was somewhere else, I think, that they have Cumberson's dolphins. Very
interesting.
Very, very beautiful. But anyway, so that's what we know from for reproduction, right? Which isn't too much. But they love to play and they love to jump around. And I think they are more social than possibly our porpoise friends. We still don't know about them either. But there is more indication that there is a bit more there. So with that, we are going to take a quick break and we'll come back with the status and some new research. And I had to stop myself on the new research because there was some other, I was like, okay, keep going. We only have an hour. We gotta stop. So we'll get to that after just a quick break. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research. And I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. Okay, we're back. So now Kat's going to talk about the status, which I feel isn't going to have, or at least the population numbers aren't going to be a whole long. We don't know a whole lot, but I'll let you go.
Yeah, so basically for these guys, we're in terms of their status, they're basically data deficient, would be the quick way to sum it up. So we have had some aerial surveys done. So aerial surveys done in the northern Strait of Magellan estimated about 3,220 animals, and in the eastern Strait of Magellan about 900. So that's around about just over 4,000 animals in the overall Strait of Magellan. Beyond that, we don't know a lot. So, I mean, okay, you're kind of like extrapolating up from that, really. The Kerguelen population is completely unknown. We do have more research that is beginning to happen in that region. And we know that the largest group observed was over 100 animals near the edge of the continental shelf. However, we do know with things like harbor porpoises that aggregate in these larger numbers, that doesn't mean that those animals all necessarily stick around there all year round. You know, it just, seeing a large aggregation isn't necessarily indicative of what the population is. But we just don't know for that location. Chilean populations, we do know, likely declined significantly due to hunting pressure. And there is some postulation that those animals may have moved into the Strait of Magellan to avoid being hunted. They also do. Yeah. And I'll get into that when we get into the threats. In the late 1980s and early 90s, they found that both solitary Commerson's dolphins and aggregations of more than 100 were sighted fairly regularly along the north coast of Tierra del Fuego. So it seems like they're a fairly steady population of around about 4,000, at least in that Strait of Magellan area, but we really don't know beyond that. In terms of their protection level, small cetaceans in Argentina and Chile have been protected by regulations since 1970s. We do know that permits are required for any take of these animals, but of course, in this location, enforcement is really difficult due to just geographical restrictions. No regulations exist at all in the Falkland or Malvinas Islands. Conservation areas have been proposed in order to protect their habitat, at least. And speaking of animals being in captivity, live captures are banned currently, at least in Argentina, until we know more about the species and their current population levels. However, despite that, some have still been captured live in recent years, and they do seem to survive relatively well in captivity, especially for a smaller cetacean. Which is kind of interesting. Again, like I haven't gone to too many marine mammal captive areas, but it's interesting to me that animals from this location would actually do okay in captivity for some reason, because this is pretty wild water. Like we said, it just seems like not anything like their normal
environment. Well, and again, similar to porpoises, like porpoises don't do well in captivity. That's mainly why they're not there. I mean, bottlenose dolphins are the most hardy ones. That's really why they're so ubiquitous. So it's interesting that these our guys aren't as delicate. Well, maybe they're not as delicate because they live in this freaking Antarctic waters.
That's true. And if they are more generalist, like they might just be more adaptable than some of these other species. So getting into the threats, let's talk about what else is taxing these guys. So obviously, again, like we said, there is still a chance of live capture, albeit relatively rare now. Really the biggest one is bycatch and active hunting. So active hunting, especially in South America, these are Commerson's dolphins and other small cetaceans are used as crab bait. There's a massive southern king crab fishery down there. And so these guys are often hunted and used for crab bait, food, and for their oil, apparently. Traditionally, people in Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego would have harpooned them and used them for meat and oil. So it seems like these have been a consistent food source for a lot of years. A lot of these practices are now illegal And have steadily begun to decline. But of course, there's still going to be those fishermen who persist in using these animals for bait, which is interesting.
And I think we talked about this, was it when we did the Peale's
Yeah, because that
dolphins?
peels are also not super large. So I think when it says like small cetaceans, I think peels are
Yeah.
included in that group as well. Yeah.
And then we were talking about the fact that, like, why are you feeding crab dolphin meat? Because that's not what
They
they
actually
eat, but I
prefer
guess,
chicken.
right?
But anyway, yeah, it's yeah, and again, like I think that's if it's a huge fishery, that makes sense. Like you're going to just use whatever you can that's available to you and that works, you
Well, and
know.
that's one big animal will feed a lot of crab, give a lot of crab bait versus smaller fish, so it makes sense.
So tying into that, these guys are also susceptible to bycatch. So again, very similar to small porpoises like the harbor porpoise. Off of South America, they are the most frequent species to be caught in fishing nets, which again, they are coastal too. So they're going to be interacting with a lot of these fisheries as well.
Right.
And in off of South America, there's one website I found said that there's at least 50 dolphins caught in wide mesh nets every year. They seem to be able to avoid the finer mesh nets, which is kind of curious. I don't know if that would maybe show up more on their sonar, whereas like the fine mesh nets actually can show up as a wall sometimes because it's closer,
No,
the
it makes
mesh is
sense.
closer
The yeah,
together.
the holes are smaller, so it looks,
Yeah, which the wide mesh nets often, and I think they found the same for porpoise, that it's harder for them to see it, you know, quote unquote. Some are bycaught by trawlers offshore in northern Patagonia as well. However, because they're often used as bait, the fishermen don't even try to avoid catching them a lot of
Like,
times. They're like,
oops.
oh, well, oops, oh, well, we got them. Never mind. I mean, so this is a thing, right, where it's not good, but at least they're using them rather than just throwing them back in the water, like a lot of times happens with bycatch. So it's not a good situation either way, but I guess at least they're using them. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
It's
hard.
tricky. But again, there's no incentive for them to not try to catch them either. So they're not really open to trying different methods of fisheries. Aside from that, contamination is another issue. So they have found low levels of PCBs and even DDT, which is, of course, illegal in the US, has been found in the
Persistent.
blubber of, very persistent, found in the blubber of the Kerguelen dolphin population, which is far from any known source of either of these organic chemicals. So while these levels
Imagine.
are less, while these are less severe than animals in the North Atlantic, for example, that's almost more worrying that they are still being found in these farther south regions where it's far from any source of this pollution.
Mostly you start, we start seeing like microplastics all the way down the Antarctic. Like there's no plastic down there, but it's still there. So it just emphasizes what we do here influences things out across the world.
Absolutely. And of course, predation. So, because they are smaller, Commerson's dolphins are prey for leopard seals, sharks, and orcas throughout their range. So that,
Pandas eating
oh, look at that, right? I thought it was funny that no one made a reference to killer whales when they were like in their nicknames,
Right?
like, you know, baby
Surprising.
orcas or like little orca. No,
Yeah, like, I
scum
mean, they look
dolphins.
more, I would say they have more of the dark, black and white coloration than like a doll's porpoise does, and they get mistaken for baby orcas. So, like,
I know. I mean, I guess like I don't know. I guess down in this area, maybe, you know, we do have more of like the different ecotypes of orcas, and maybe the orcas are less commonly observed. I don't know.
that's true. Who knows? But
But yeah, I kind of thought that was curious too, where I'm like, oh, no, okay. Anyway.
yeah, like somebody's got to make that joke. Sea panda
Hey,
eating
come
panda dolphin.
well, we're making it. So that's
There
all I have for the
you
threads. I do have some fun facts, but why don't we do the current research first and then we'll end with some fun
cool.
facts.
As I was putting that pin in before, there was a study on their vocalizations, and we actually either did, I think we either did this one as a general review, or it was when we talked about the Peale's dolphin. Because this was for Peale's and Commerson's together. They looked at the narrowband high frequency clicks, and they found that the structure of their clicks may be an adaptation to reduce the clutter when foraging in a coastal environment. So it was the coastal versus the open ocean, and the way that they structure it. I'm not going to go into the details of that because I don't fully understand all the acoustic stuff. And it doesn't really matter in this context, right? You just need to know that they have evolved their high frequency clicks to seemingly reduce the clutter that they're in with the sediment and stuff that gets pulled up with coastal areas, and it's just more it's murkier, I guess, than open ocean plastic water. So that one was interesting. They did, again, a lot of the papers are a combination of Peel's, Dusky, and Commerson's all together, looking at their, because they're sympatric, right? They overlap in ranges and sometimes hang out together, as we discussed earlier. So this is by Garofo et al. In 2011, and they were modeling the habitat. And they found that the Commerson's were more coastally distributed than the other species, and more often found feeding in estuarine zones, so the places where salt, like the mouth of the rivers, those kind of things. And they were not correlated, so the Peels and Dusky dolphins were positively correlated with each other where they hung out, and then the Commerson's dolphins were separate. So they, yeah, had to seemingly kind of separate their habitat, at least in that way. They still hang out with each other sometimes, but the Peels are the Commerson's are much more coastal. Another thing back to sound is this is from 2014. He was looking at this. So there are some of this work has been done in captivity, since we actually do have some in captivity. We can learn things from them, hopefully. So they were looking at the sound variation in these captive animals. And everything was above 110 kilohertz, which is basically the same as harbor porpoise vocalizations. The lower range of harbor porpoises is 110. So all high frequency. And they found four types based on the interclick interval. So basically click, blank space, click, blank space, click. So how short or long those spaces are in between. So anytime I say interval, I'm talking about the interclick interval. I'm just not going to say that every single time.
Just say ICI. It's abbreviated to.
Right. So there was a decreasing one that had a continually decreasing intervals during the last part. So I think that's very similar to like a terminal buzz that we've talked about, or we may have talked about with dolphins, where it goes click, 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 and it sounds like almost like you can't hear the space in between the clicks. And that would happen, it increased with a new object that was put in the pool. So this is very much likely for echolocation, and they're trying to figure out, you know what it is. Then there was an increasing with a continually increasing ICI or interval during the last part. So it spaces out farther apart. And this was rarely recorded during approach to an object, but increased when approaching another dolphin, and also increased with social behaviors. So that's, again, leaning more towards some communication type aspect.
Communication, or maybe even recognition, where there's less need to more buzz it more intensely because you already recognize what it is.
You're like, oh, that's a foul dolphin. I know what you are.
Right, yeah. Right.
Then there was fluctuating with fluctuating intervals, and I didn't read the full paper, but in the abstract there was no link to anything on that one. It just said that it happened, so I'm not sure if they know what that one is. And then there's a burst pulse type, and a burst pulse is a vocalization that is like part echolocation and part whistles. Kind of think of it as an excited toddler that's like blah. they're really hard to understand because it's not just a frequency whistle. It's not just an echolocation buzz. It's this combination of the two. And so we don't know as much about burst pulse type calls as we do other vocalizations. At least I feel we still don't. It was true years ago when I had some more connection with acoustic stuff in the Bahamas. But these ones are burst pulse type with a short and constant interval, so not increasing or decreasing. And these suddenly increased in front of the object, and when they were often oriented directly towards it. And so this suggests that this is the echolocation in close proximity of the object, and it also increased with social behaviors. So the most important thing to remember from this study is that they are suggesting that these narrow band high frequency clicks have functions other than echolocation, such as communication. And this is something we've seen more recently with harbor porpoises, coming out that these clicks are not just echolocation. They are seeing these in other social behaviors and things like that. So again, that there's more sociality to these animals that we thought, oh, they don't have whistles, so therefore they're not really social. They don't talk to each other. So I thought that was very cool. These narrowband high frequency clicks that we didn't even know existed until like 20 years ago when we could record them, have a lot more than just they're not a one-trick pony. There's a lot more that you can do. then Rischialdi et al. In 2013 looked at ontogenetic diet shifts. So this is basically looking at the genetics of what these animals are eating and looking at age differences. So onto is usually with age discretion. So they found, and sex, they found shifts in diet among the age and sex. So they analyzed bones with the collagen in them and the carbon and nitrogen isotopic markers from 220 individuals. And I'm assuming that these were bicot or stranded. And what's really cool is these isotopic markers. We've talked about these before in other podcasts, in that they can tell you where an animal is feeding trophically. So depending on the isotopic niche that these particular prey items have, that gets taken in and stored in the animal, you can then say, oh, they're feeding at this level or a higher level or lower level compared to other things. So they all age classes share the same area as far as we know, but it seems that their diet shifts. So juveniles consume a higher mean proportion of pelagic Spratus fuegnensis, whatever fish that is. So 60% compared to 36% of adults. Consumption of benthopelagic, so bottom and ocean, open ocean species like Ilex argentinus and Logigo gahi, was higher in adults than juveniles, so 33 to 20%. And so basically there is a difference. The juveniles are eating things, significantly different things than adults. And it's, they suggested that this is a possible improvement of foraging skills as you get to an adult. Like you can't, the juveniles can't catch the things that the adults are getting because they haven't honed their foraging skills yet. And also expansion of habitat as they get bigger, they may adventure out farther. They didn't find any difference in sexes. So there's no evidence for sex-related resource partitioning, even though they think males go out farther, but they're still, there's no differences in what they're eating. And then again, this was kind of cool. So the decrease in the nitrogen values in calves versus juveniles suggested that the nursing ends at between half a year and a year. So it's confirming what I thought. This was really, I've never seen nursing time frames figured out through isotopic marker research. Yeah,
makes sense though. Makes total sense.
Right. You can tell like what they're eating based on those markers. So it does look like that 4 to 5, you know, between 4 to 6 months of beginning weaning for these guys. And the artisanal fisheries do not affect the long-term food habits because they don't overlap much trophically. What the fishermen are getting is different than what they're eating, but there's still a major source of mortality because of bycatch, as you already mentioned. Then we just have two more. So this is Coscarella et al. In 2011. And this is, they looked at body size and ranging patterns on the sociality of the dolphins. So anytime we do research, these new research things, if there's something social or social structure, I'm going to grab those ones because that's kind of my most, what I find very interesting. But they did photo ID of these animals, and I'm not sure exactly what markers they used, but they were able to do photo ID with animals seen two or more times near Argentina. So they had 48 individuals. They did show that there were random associations over short time. So they're just like all hanging out, whatever, together. But they were non-random for longer time. So it seems that there are some animals had more stable partners over the long term rather than the short term. Mm-hmm. The lagged association rates and identification rates, which basically show how likely an animal is to be reassociated with another individual over time, remained in the area for about 15 days and then moved away as those original groups dissolved. So very fission-fusion type system, similar to other dolphin species. But what's interesting is that the strength of associations coincides with the predictions that they make regarding body size and ranging patterns. So in the past, another study, it was proposed that group stability of dolphins decreased with body size. So the smaller the animal gets, the less likely they are to remain together in those small groups or have longer associations. And then another one proposed that predictability of resources leads to formation of small, relatively stable groups. So you basically, it's similar with porpoises, right? They need predictable food sources, and it's, maybe it's better to be in those smaller groups during that time. But then when there's a big bloom or whatever, they congregate and aggregate in those 100 plus groups. So very similar in that way. So what they're finding out about their social structure does seem to kind of line up with what they thought before, with how big they are and where they go and what the resources are. So the last one I'm going to talk about was in 2022. So all these other ones were 2011, 2013, 2014. You know, I guess it's, I think those are recent, but then I think about, I'm like, oh, those are 10 years ago. I mean, that's still recent, but you just kind of forget, you know, time frame of where we're at. But this one was in 2022. So this one's very recent. And this was, they looked at population structure through population genetics. So they used 70 skin samples that were, I think, already, at least some of them were already in GenBank. So this is a great example of using, when people get a sample, it gets uploaded into this GenBank, and then people, other researchers can access it. So you don't have to go out and get 70 skin samples yourself. You can use what's already there and do this work. So they used mitochondrial DNA. They found low genetic diversity, which makes sense for smaller populations that are isolated. And I did find one thing is interesting. They were talking about how separated they are. They're like, we have no idea how these two animal two populations of them got so far apart. And like, how did, there's no connection between the two, right? Of how they got there. And I think, you know, some group just kind of wandered off and then got stuck over the other islands. But smaller populations generally probably have lower genetic diversity because they're not mixing. But they found strong population structure that's consistent with female phylopatry. So the females are the ones that are staying, which is again what they thought with males going farther. But it was not detected when using microsatellite markers. So that indicates male-mediated gene flow. So similar to many other dolphin populations, the females hang out where they are, and the males are the ones that go roving off and mixing up the genes. So they suggested considering each sampling location as an independent population management unit in order to evaluate the impact of possible environmental changes on the distribution of this genetic information within the species. So I thought it was a really good one to end on because a lot of the problem, and I was just doing this with my marine mammal class, the biggest issue with conserving species is understanding what management unit is appropriate to understand to do the, is it this whole population? Do we have to look at these separately, these subpopulations? Or communities. So this is just another one showing that, yeah, that's an important thing to understand, to be able to understand their genetic, how they're all genetically linked and what that means long term for conservation. So so that's it. That's, like I said, there was more, and I could have kept going as I could every week on those, but those are kind of the fun highlights of ones that we know. So we are learning more about these animals that are so far away from everybody else in the world. And hopefully we'll continue to know more. As people are interested, and the technology allows us to better be able to be out there or put passive acoustic devices out and listen to them.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So you've a couple fun facts.
Yes. So since we're talking about divergent animals, let's just hit this one first. So in 2004, a Commerson's dolphin was seen swimming off the coast of South Africa, which
Whoa.
is over 4,000 kilometers from the Kerguelen Islands and more than 6,000 kilometers away from South America.
Wow.
So no, nobody knows how this animal ended up so far away from its range.
Major
There,
walkabout.
animals like this are known as vagrants, where they're basically like, we have no idea how the heck you, it's like the walrus that was found off of like whales in
Yeah.
Cornwall. It's
Or the
like,
beluga that was down in Monterey Bay. Like,
right,
what?
exactly. Where it's like, what are you doing?
Or the gray
So that
whale in
was
the
kind of,
Atlantic.
right. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then just some other random fun facts. So they are named after a French naturalist, Dr. Philibert Commerson, who first discovered them in the Strait of Magellan in 1767.
Very
Super long
cool.
ago. They have between 116 and 120 teeth.
That's
Kind of
awesome.
fun. Interestingly enough, the Commerson's dolphins have a gland at the corner of their eyes, which secretes lubricating oil, which I thought was very interesting.
Can they cry?
I don't know. That's an
Interesting.
excellent question. I don't know. But that was kind of cool and random.
I wonder what, like, do other species in the Antarctic have that? Like, or is it just,
That's what I
yeah.
was wondering, as like a Southern Ocean thing. Like, I'm
Yeah.
not sure, but thought that was pretty cool. And then just again, kind of referring back to those animals in captivity. So they are thought to live about 10 years in the wild, which is really short, actually, for a dolphin species.
Yeah, again, that's more similar to porpoises. Like, that's a,
From what
yeah.
we think, yeah. One individual in an aquarium died at 18, while I believe the oldest living animal was in SeaWorld and lived to be about 25.
Yeah, I
So,
have, that's the only one, that's the only fun fact I had left was that one. So 25.8,
yeah.
they said at SeaWorld. So,
Yeah, so like 25 and three
yeah.
quarters, basically. So, yeah, they kind of extrapolate that to be about 10 years-ish for long, you know, natural death in animals in the wild.
Yeah, and I think that's with porpoises too. We don't know. It's like 8 to 24 years. We don't know, but we do know some have lived to 24. But most of the animals that they, get in bycatch is no more than 10 years of age. So it's very similar lifespan, which I guess maybe is size related too, just how long they can live.
Yeah, that was all I had for fun facts for these guys.
These piebald skunk panda dolphins that often get
The
mistaken for
dolphin of many names. They're
porpoises.
so cool.
And
Super
I
cool.
just find it funny that they're mistaken for porpoises because of the way they look, but then you could mistake them for porpoises with many of the behaviors and just how they live, which is super interesting. I thought these were really cool, besides just being cool looking. Oh, I was gonna say the tear or the lubricant. I wonder if it has to do with their more coastal versus the other ones. So the clutter in, maybe they're protecting their eyes, that there's more sediment or something in the water there.
That's a good point, right? And there is a lot of obviously wave action and stuff around that part of the world. So yeah, very possibly. Who
Yeah,
knows?
maybe. Cool. Very interesting. Well, as always, we always learn at least one, if not usually many more things about all these different animals that we talk about, and it's super fun. So next time we'll have probably a journal review. Again, email us if you have anything that you wanted us to talk about, if there's something new and upcoming in the world, or just a topic that you're interested in, let us know. Make sure you check out our merch shop on the website. We have a lot of cool stuff, and designs and mugs, and I don't know what else. We have canvas bags and t-shirts and sweatshirts and all that kind of stuff. A couple different designs to choose from. So check that out. Be sure to keep an eye on Instagram and Facebook for our social media, and on Instagram stories for the next time to vote for the Marine Mammal Highlights series next month. So with that, we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.